Welcome to MAP, the bi-weekly market access podcast provided by Mars Market Access and Pricing Strategy, which is your healthcare consultancy in the German-speaking markets. Mars makes it as easy as possible for you to get your pharmaceutical, medtech, or digital health product to the market and, of course, get the price it deserves. My name is Stefan Walzer. I'm the founder of Mars and a health economist by training and working in the fields of market access, reimbursement, pricing, and health economics already since 2004. Additionally, I founded the consultancy P&N Pricing and Negotiations in Healthcare based in Toronto, Canada, which supports companies and individuals globally by coaching, simulations, and training, especially on negotiations. This service is including our innovative virtual reality simulation program and is part of the Negotiation Lab. And now let's learn about the market access and reimbursement systems around the globe. So welcome to another episode with the Market Access Podcast. Today I have Aymeric Chopin from the US, and we have, I think, a really good kind of content, not only for the US. I think we have had some already episodes on the US, but I think especially also linking a bit the various types what we all need in the reimbursement discussion, which is coding, which is reimbursement pathways, which is real life, and which is also the medical practice. So a lot of different things to discuss about today. But before we jump into the content, Aymeric, it would be great if you could just introduce yourself very briefly.
Thank you, Stefan. So I am Aymeric Chopin. I've been in consulting in pricing market access in the US for the past now 14, 15 years, including Canada, when I was staying there. So I was born in the US, but my family's French, so forgive me for my accent. But I grew up knowing about both systems, and because of the contrast between the US and, let's say, the French system, which is close to other systems like the Italian or the British one, that contrast, that shock, allowed me to understand a little bit more in depth things that some American specialists don't look into because they don't think it's absurd like Europeans would think. And trying to make sense of all of that has been one of my favorite activities for the past decade.
Very good. Perfect. So I think that gives already kind of very good frame, especially I think as you also understand quite a bit, I think, of also the other systems, which I think sometimes also important to maybe get a bit all of the kind of discussions into the right kind of perspectives. But before maybe getting to all of those different flavors and discussions, I think it would be good if you could give us an overview of the current healthcare reimbursement pathways in the US, and maybe also directly link it a bit to the potential impact on the delivery of healthcare services in general.
So they're absolutely linked. The US has a major access problem to adequate treatments simply because of how many third parties are involved in the process. So you'll take the example of France. You have your physician, you have what is called the Assurance Maladie, which is the sickness fund, which is a public institution that is part of Social Security. The prescription is reimbursed. There's no question asked, except if there's obvious malpractice. But even then, if the doctor writes, "I said," on the prescription, people have to deliver even off-label, but they might investigate later or not reimburse. However, the process for the patient is seamless. In the US, patients have to first and foremost look into their coverage. So coverage is not exactly reimbursement. Coverage says that you will be reimbursed depending on whether or not the medical treatment you receive, the procedure, is considered medically necessary. So that's a lot of private health plans, managed care organizations are called. Their goal is to save money on healthcare. That's why they were allowed through a bill in Congress, I think in 93. And MCOs are going to ensure that they give access to the most proven medications, that they will never deny coverage since the Affordable Care Act was passed. However, they can limit coverage considerably. And also, sometimes some procedures, let's think about autism spectrum disorder. There are 1,000 specialists only in the US, and most of them are out of network or don't take insurance. So you have families that have health insurance that work, that will have to pay out of pocket for the behavioral therapy of their child. And at the same time, that impacts their work life, their own health, And so it creates a domino effect where you see entire families waiting to be extremely sick to see a doctor. Because here's the thing that people don't understand. As a patient, you have what is called a deductible when you have private health insurance. Okay, so under 65 years old, everybody is on private health insurance or Medicaid if they're at a certain level of income that's considered too low. When you have these private health insurances, you know that you have to pay out of pocket about $2,000 to $4,000, depending on your health plan, before you're fully reimbursed with no questions asked. So during those, a lot of people say, I'm going to wait until I get my deductible done before seeing the specialist. So they'll go see the dermatologist, small procedures left and right. They can pay the copay for or the coinsurance, the copay being for the medication, the copay for the medical practice and the coinsurance for the medication. So that's number one. They're going to wait. So that's a problem in America because of three diseases that are the most expensive in America: cardiovascular diseases, metabolic diseases, so obesity, type 2 diabetes, not type 1, but type 2 diabetes, everything that is environmental. And third, cancer. And people will wait. And as you know, colorectal prostate cancer, if caught on time, the survival rate is almost 90% after 5 years. But if it metastasizes, it's over. Not over, but I mean, it's really bad. And that limits also the treatments. Well, now you understand why many pharmaceutical companies study not first-line medications in cancer, but last line. Also, it's easier because you don't have survival data at first to, be an adjuvant therapy and then a monotherapy. But that begs a question: why was it an adjuvant therapy first and now it's a monotherapy? That means that through accelerated approvals, which is a procedure that the FDA allows, you have drugs that are not technically for Europeans, would not be considered reimbursable because they're not proven to work. They use composite endpoints, single-arm trials, because that's authorized for major diseases that have an urgent need. But as you see, all these drugs are being used left and right. And that explains why health plans in America are very, very skeptical about a lot of these products, especially think about the PCSK9s, how they failed, even though there is potential in the drug. And they failed because they, not because of clinical data, but more or less because they did not reduce the number of cardiovascular events to a point that would justify having it as a preferred product. In terms of volume, it was, if I remember, through outcomes-based contracts for Repatha and Praluent, it was about $1,000 to $2,000 a year, so only of savings. So patients have this problem that they don't know these things. So when they arrive at the pharmacy, they can be switched to a new drug, a new brand they never tried. They never titrated for it. And they either accept and try it. And you know how switching treatments can derail actually the efficacy of treatment. Think about insulin therapy. You don't change that every 6 months. So patients oftentimes don't have a choice to take the treatment that is covered and in network. So depending on where you live, depending on your level of income, depending on your professional life, it can be extremely difficult to know if you're receiving proper healthcare. And coverage, unlike reimbursement, means that you know that every expense you make at the doctor, out of pocket, the reimbursement is conditioned to a policy and coding that you have no control over as a patient. So if the physician's office makes a mistake in coding that delays your reimbursement, to some families, when you spend $2,000 a month, that's catastrophic. So coverage is that main. So most patients, because they don't understand what's happening, wait until they really need to see a doctor. So that leads to more expenses, more costs, and to social issues. The access in America is really conditioned not just by money, but by policies and coding. And so here's the big problem. Doctors, nurses, healthcare providers do not understand coding. Coders are not doctors. So we end up with lots of coding issues that delay reimbursement coverage. And now you understand why pharmaceutical companies offer as a way to entice health plans to put them on a preferred formulary position, offers them, we will have a hub and doctors can call us and we'll tell them right away if the patient is covered or not. And if it's not covered, or for example, if the patient cannot pay right away, we will offer samples. And then it becomes a problem, samples, because it can be disguised as a discount, which goes against Medicaid best price policy. So a patient can learn all of a sudden that the drug was not to be prescribed to them. What does it mean? Does it mean it's bad clinically? No, the MCO is just saying, or the PBM, the pharmacy benefit manager, he should have never given you that drug. That doesn't mean it doesn't work. That means that drug was not covered. So as you can see, in Europe, that sounds absurd, but here in America, it's not exactly a free market anymore with the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, or most infamously known as Obamacare by its detractors. It's not just guaranteeing health insurance, a minimum health insurance funded by the government if you don't have enough money. It's also controlling outcomes. And in America, a lot of the NQF, which is the National Quality Foundation or Forum, if I don't remember, they have quality measures that have been used through the ACA and were part of the system, the computerizing, if I may, of the healthcare system in America. Prior to Obamacare, many practices weren't computerized. And the reason for that was, and I know it sounds insane, that was an argument, sharing medical data between hospitals and physicians is anti-competitive. Those are competitors. They're going to take our business. So the mentality was really there. I can give you an example. I know somebody who had a cyst under their armpit that was really becoming big, went to a dermatologist to get it fixed. She had to appeal the decision by the health plan, even after Obamacare, saying that was cosmetic, not medically necessary. You can survive with that pain. So I know it's been quite a long introduction, but really to understand that reimbursement happens once after. So you go to a physician knowing you're covered, but reimbursement is still conditioned. And it's like the lottery. You don't know if you as a patient are going to get all the money back. With the deductible, that creates a situation. For instance, I went to see several doctors in 1 year. I reached my deductible. However, it was the end of the year, and out of pocket, I had spent about $700 for one visit for an x-ray and a dermatologist just for a mole and for a biopsy of the mole. That gives you an idea of how much money. I didn't have the best insurance, but still, that explains why in America, elderly people are going to seek healthcare, but they're already extremely sick, diabetes, obesity, because they didn't take care of their health before because it was too expensive. They reach Medicare. They know they get more coverage, but then you have the 20 and 30 year olds that never see a doctor called the invincibles, but they're not invincible. And I'll explain a little later why that's a problem in terms of the health plan you choose when you seek health insurance in America.
Yeah, exactly. Emmerich, I think this gives really a big and broad kind of, let's say, introduction overview, I think, of the US healthcare system. And also, I think a bit of the problems, but I think maybe just putting a couple of things again together, I think one of the most important things would, I think at least most of Europeans have when thinking about the US and the US healthcare market, is that they are at least very innovation friendly. Everybody thinks very high prices. Yes, there's the issue with the kind of, let's say, coverage slash reimbursement. I think everybody knows more or less that, right? But I think innovation friendliness was always, let's say, on the top of the list. Which I think when I hear that is not exactly the whole kind of story, right? It might just be the first thing, but which is more the kind of, let's say, I think you said it, it's basically kind of coverage, right? But then the reimbursement question just comes after. So I think how could then really companies be also commercially successful, medical devices and also pharmaceuticals in the US, knowing all of those kind of bigger kind of issues, and you need big programs and have a big country and a lot of players, I think a lot of stakeholders and a lot of regulations also between the states, I guess. So what is the kind of flavor where you would say still it is probably still the most important market across the world? Or maybe it isn't. I don't know. What do you think?
Last time I checked, 80% of pharmaceutical global revenue is the US alone.
Yeah.
And I'll give an example, sterile solutions for your eyes. I think the pack of 100 in Europe is about €8.99. In America, it's $300 over the counter. because there's no price ceiling. So when we're talking about innovation, you're absolutely right. So you have accelerated approval, you have the orphan drug designation. But the problem with that is the FDA does not judge whether or not the drug, it will state if the drug is efficacious or effective in real world, but it will not stop it from reaching the market as long as it is safe, even though it's not proven to work. And that creates a problem. There's been a loophole and it's been criticized by MCOs. Let's take, for example, the Hep C drug. It sounds like an eternity, $300,000. Health plans were saying, you have to understand, we're asking one injection or twice a year, if you remember. It cures it. Okay, thank you. Here's a horrible question. Is the cure, the cost saving on the cure, the fact that those people are not sick anymore, really, for the price tag, going to change how access is enabled for other major expenses, cardiovascular diseases? I remember VP of pharmacy saying, at one point, we can't, if we fund the Hep C drug, we're going to end up not having enough money for cardiovascular. So that limits our ability to cover new drugs for cardiovascular health. But this is where the vice comes up. Pharmaceutical companies have except for biotech companies, I'm thinking about Amarin and Vascepa, very few companies have actually developed new drugs, efficacious, without doubt, for cardiovascular health, diabetes, obesity, because those are major populations, tens of millions of people in America, around the world, hundreds of millions. That, by definition, means that the volume will force the drug to be priced low. But the problem with that is that revenue, it's an overcrowded market. However, we still need new solutions. So with these rules created by the FDA, that allows a lot of company to get single-arm trial drugs that are extremely expensive for orphan diseases that cost $1 million, $2 million, gene therapies, one injection. Health plans are mandated, most of them, to cover life-threatening or heavily debilitating disease treatments. So recently, I don't know what drug it was, I have to double check, there was literally in the label, there's no evidence that this drug works for the indicated disease in the label. They have to pay for it. Health plans have to pay if it's prescribed. So that creates an absurd system where innovation has been corrupted, if you will, by the fact that now it's not really innovative because these drugs don't reach Europe before 5 to 6 years after America because they don't have the evidence. Even the single arm trial, they have like biomarkers, surrogate endpoints, not the primary endpoints. And I'm not just thinking about Germany. You look at France, you look at Italy, there's a lot of questions about several drugs that were released. So in America, you have, you know, think about psoriasis. A lot of drugs in America for arthritic psoriasis or psoriasis are approved by DMA, but not covered or covered at 60%, 40% reimbursement rate of the generic. So this is the problem with America right now, and everybody wants to fix it, is that it creates a bottleneck where pharmaceutical companies, to make more money more rapidly, to ensure revenue, develop drugs for very small subpopulations because they know that their data is not strong enough to have the whole population. And then they're going to use real-world evidence, which is problematic. That means that once the drug is released, they go to the most desperate people who need that drug. Then they're going to show, look, it's started to work. Then they arrive in Europe and they're surprised that real-world evidence is not going to be accepted. Because it's, you know, you look at all real-world evidence studies in the US, they're one or two centers. The reason for that is to prove to a health plan, a regional health plan or a national one over several states, that with their population, it works. Now, here's the other dirty little secret. Maybe it doesn't work as well as the generic. But with the discounts, it seems to be working as well through cost budget impact, not cost effectiveness. So you see, that's a major problem in the US right now, is really innovation has lost its way. And we're having more and more drugs that are single arm trial. To this day, 53%, if I remember, 49% of single arm trial drug that were approved since 1993 have never received confirmatory phase 3 data on the excuse that it's difficult. Yes, but not for all therapies. And that's where, you know, so you see that innovation is problematic because it's like Japan. They have the same problem. A lot of single arm trial data is accepted for Japanese companies when developed in Japan. And then when they arrived in Europe and America, they're surprised it's not going to pass.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, it's an interesting point. We just also just bring up there. I mean, could you maybe as well shed a bit of light, basically, how is basically, let's say, reimbursement from a practical perspective? I mean, if I would be coming as a, maybe call it a European company, and I want to, let's say, launch into the US, and I have my experts for the US FDA and I get approval. So then I basically have the second step, right? Which is more contracting, coverage. Yes. Getting on the health plans. Also, bit of a question, are we getting a bit of Europeanized as well in the US with
no
potential inclusion of cost effectiveness and negotiation which are coming up there? Just big question mark. Include there a bit as well. I mean, it is getting even more complex, right?
So cost effectiveness is a major no-no for health plans in America because most people stay 2 years on their health plan. Mm. So maybe the benefit of the cost effectiveness of the drug will benefit their competitor once the patient changes. So that was a discussion. Now it's called shared. So what they do is that they do a contract that if the patient changes, the company, the health plan for which the patient changes will send back some money to the other health plan, but it's never really been realized. So that's why it's budget impact. And that creates another difficulty. It's about right now. Does it work right now? So imagine how they felt when Gene and CAR-Ts arrived. They're like, we're paying once and the result are in 5 to 8 years that we are sure about them. We're not going to survive. We're paying $2 million right away. That's our budget. Think about regional plans. That's our budget for, let's say, locally diabetes. Well, it's probably more expensive. But you see, the problem is that for children, getting that injection in the state, that's a huge budget impact on the health plan. And that's where you have the major issue is that most major health plans that are linked to Medicare because they cover Part D, I'm thinking about UnitedHealthcare, will take the drug, cover it to label. They can sustain it. But regional health plans cannot. So when young companies, biotech companies from Europe arrive in America, they have to understand one thing. The result has to be immediate. And how? What are the favorite measures for health plans? It's quality measures. So 30-day readmission at the hospital rate, ER visits, healthcare. So all of these are considered not like in Germany as signs of patient well-being, but in America as, well, the patient's still going to the hospital and nothing's changed since we switched the treatment. Therefore, give us back our money. So that's why outcomes-based contracts also were a problem in America. And they failed because I remember negotiating some with for some pharmaceutical companies and health plans. They want one endpoint that is like, after a month, if that endpoint doesn't reach that level, we pay back. The problem is that nobody agrees on what's the real threshold for that endpoint to show clinical efficacy. Think about RSV ophthalmology. Every physician I met, ophthalmologist, told me retina thickness reduced by 100% after 3 months proves the treatment works. But nobody can put in a contract 100% reduction. That would be catastrophic because some investors wouldn't understand. So then there's a debate, 75%, 50%. But that means that's not efficacious. You're not really looking at efficacy. And then other ophthalmologists told me enough with medical plans dictating medical practice, which is illegal, but indirectly, by telling us to stop a treatment because it's not covered anymore, it's not working, when maybe the treatment is slowing down disease, but that was not studied in the clinical trial. Mm-hmm. So we end up with these situations where physicians, right now, we have very few, so that's the downfall of the bad part of the ACA, if you will, because computerization and data reporting is so important and so heavy. They need to be hired by a clinical company that has facilities and will be there to do that job for the physician and also cover them in case of a lawsuit. So we have fewer and fewer medical practices. There are clinical centers of several physicians, and we have what we call horizontal and vertical integration, which is literally physician practices merging with health plans, merging with pharmacies, merging with data hubs. That creates situations of monopoly, and the most infamous one was in 2016. If I remember, it was Cigna trying to, or was it CVS? Because the Congress considered that it was a monopoly, they derailed the merger, and they decided to leave several market exchange places as a slide to the Obama administration. in the middle of the elections. So it's also highly political. And healthcare in America, think about access for women's health. I'm not just talking about abortion. I'm talking about everything else. There are Catholic hospitals. They do not cover any of these practices, contraception or not. And if you talk to them about that, they might hang up on you because they have values that are in their... So that would be illegal in Europe, but not here. So that's a major issue. And so you understand that access to patients is more like a roadmap that you're trying to decipher, and then you end up still lost.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I mean, yeah, it's a real complex market. I mean, every market is very complex and very, let's say, unique and so on, right? But I think that sounds really, I think, even, I would say, another kind of beast. But I would like to end still a bit positive, because companies are still moving into the US, and as you as well said, I think if you're looking at the numbers, we still see, let's say, 80% of the revenues of most of the companies are getting out of the US. So what kind of advice would you give maybe startups or companies from outside of the US in order to, let's say, navigate through all of those complexities in the US with respect to coverage, reimbursement, co-payments, et cetera, et cetera? So what is the kind of advice you would give? Maybe the 3-4 things what they should for sure do before entering the market.
Number one, you need representatives. So either you hire a third-party company that will take independent contractors that will go to regional health plans to negotiate for you the placement of your product. Because without that, you will not be covered by 80% of those regional plans are very important. And maybe you will have bad formulary placement in major national MCOs or PBMs. So the first advice is you have to choose whether you're going to partner with a major pharmaceutical group to use their sales force to help you launch your drug. Or if you want to stay independent, that means you have to think about investing in people. Either you hire an agency that doesn't work for you, but that means there's still an intermediary, there could be mistakes. But if you do it on your own, that's very daunting. Salaries in America are 2 to 3 times superior to Europe. And you pay for health insurance at a point that even taxes in Europe don't reflect. So very expensive and very complex on the human resources side. So I would say you have to choose whether you want to exit the company and selling it after your phase 2 trial to a major partner that will then launch your drug and you will have royalties. Or if you know your drug is revolutionary, then maybe the best thing to do is really to talk to the FDA early on. There are procedures to ask the FDA to help in designing the clinical trials that will be necessary not only for your approval, but for your market launch. Again, that requires a lot of legwork. So I would say every biotech company needs to make a choice before entering the US. Are we going to sell the company after phase 2 trial or phase 1B, you name it? Are we just going to partner and not be, you know, Regeneron was not a major pharmaceutical company. They partnered with Sanofi on different things and they managed to become now a major group, if you know their magic mouse. So do you want to sell? Or if you don't want to sell and you want to partner, that's the other, but then you need to negotiate with major pharmaceutical groups that have a lot of leverage. Or that's the final solution. I would say you find investments in the US. And there are several states, depending on cancers, that have boards that give funding from taxpayer on the condition that your drug will be manufactured in the state and you will hire people from the state. And if people from foreign countries must come, they need to provide a dossier justifying why they can't hire Americans to do that. So that I used to do that, all the due diligence work. And a lot of biotech companies come up in the US saying, our drug will cure people. That's not the argument. The argument is how much money is going to make and is it going to be a blockbuster drug? So those, it sounds crazy, but America considers medicine as a service, a product, not a right. So there you go. I would say biotech companies need to understand that here, they're not going to be listened to if they say their drug is going to help patients. In my whole career in America, I heard about patients in Europe. Stakeholders in America are never patients because they don't pay the health plan does.
Yeah, no, yeah. At the end of the day, I think healthcare is a business. I think for all of the stakeholders included, that is maybe, I think, at least some of the times, I would say as well, with a kind of negative touch for patients, I think, as you have as well alluded. Aymeric, I think we're basically done with the time. It was a fascinating kind of deep dive into some of the US kind of issues. I think it was very good, especially, let's say, all of the connection you made, at least for me, to the European kind of environment. So I hope that everybody's getting really a good kind of, let's say, insights out of the talk. And obviously, let's say, still, the US is a major player, let's say, into in the overall kind of the market environment for pharmaceuticals and also medical devices. So thanks again, Aymeric. Looking forward to the future.
Have a great one.
So the United States of America is another monster? Question mark. I think speaking to Aymeric, I think it was quite clear, quite evident that this is for sure true. And I think the most important thing is probably also, I think, what was always somewhere underlying in all of the kind of arguments and explanations what Aymeric was basically bringing is that healthcare is, as he also said towards the end, not a human right, but it's rather just another business. I think that's very important also to understand once and if a company wants to move into the US healthcare market. Also important is even the differences in terms of terminology. I think coverage and reimbursement are meant totally different when speaking to a European healthcare payer, when thinking about European healthcare system, whereas it is, again, very different in the US where, let's say, coverage might be given. That is also where people might still have that innovation friendliness in their mindset, but reimbursement is then really, really complex and has a lot of different kind of things to remember. Even though that, let's say, some of the potential kind of ways in terms of reimbursement and the pathway. At the end of the day, I think at the very early beginning also, Aymeric said very clearly, I think coding is very important, especially also obviously when thinking about that coverage and the reimbursement, needing to know what the coding is, needing to know, however, also how and in which ways maybe physicians and systems might apply those. So quite clearly, I think very important. I think that's also, I think, what Aymeric said as well towards the end. You need to understand the US market very, very carefully. And for sure, and that is also what successful companies have always done, you need to have people in the US in order to be commercially successful.
That was an episode of MAP, the Market Access Podcast, provided by Mars Market Access and Pricing Strategy, which is your healthcare consultancy in the German-speaking markets. MAP is available every second week with a new episode, so watch out. And in case you might have questions, contact me directly and or visit our website on www.marketaccess-pricingstrategy.de.